Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a fat lump of moss growing strong on our bedrock of culture. I'm James Sandy. In this, the last show of the series, we reflect on three local exhibitions that take on and espouse the land art movement. We have a quick think about Sheffield band Long Pigs and their place in the indie scene via a new anthology, and there's time to catch up on some upcoming events for the summer season. Joining me as ever to sort the diamond from the sediment are Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs. Welcome.
Thank you.
And welcome return. Now, last time we had a bank holiday special on sea shanties and a maritime excursion. Dave there suggested that we should go mad in the countryside.
I was feeling seasick. I wanted to get back on dry land.
So we're going to do that by exploring land art. Now, land art is a concept and a genre that I don't know a great deal about, but I've done some exploring. And Simon, you've been to see Uncommon Ground, Land Art in Britain, 1966 to 1979, at the Southampton City Art Gallery.
I have indeed, yes, and it's a very good introduction to the genre. I think what's worth mentioning is, as you said, 1966 to 1979, the sort of starting point of this genre. If you kind of think about 1966, pop would have been at its peak, both in music and in art. You'd have had artists like Lichtenstein and so on. Also, Time magazine would have produced something about Swinging London. There's something very much about pop art and consumerism being part of the art world at that point. But then what you got is the land art movement moving away from this, moving away from maybe thinking about artificial objects and man-made objects, not working in enclosed spaces, but actually going out into the landscape and forging new forms of art on a maybe more expansive kind of scale.
So it's something, land art, just to kind of try and explain what it is, or trying to unpack it slightly, is it about sort of artistic relationships with the land, or is it about using land as material, or is it a number of those things?
I think a number of those things.
Okay, yeah. That's good.
It's quite wide-ranging. It can be sculpture, it can be performance, it can be photography, which is documenting something that's taken place in the landscape. It can be conceptual, ephemeral, handmade, quite often organic. For example, you can have things such as a photographic documentation of actions taking place within the landscape. Walking and travelling are quite often a big theme, and walking and travelling can become creative acts. There's an exploration of locality, an awareness of rural traditions. I think something that's worth thinking about it to pitch it is that landscape is maybe one of the oldest genres in art. It's a very traditional genre in art. But rather than kind of dealing with this in a traditional format, land art is very much dealing with it in a dynamic and inventive form. It's not so much about making pretty pictures of the landscape. It's more about how the artists interact and record the landscape.
And Dave, you were saying about the label land art itself was kind of conjured up as a convenience to build in other things, or?
Well, I think that's right. In the same way that there's a sense, isn't there, in which labels for genres in any form of cultural practice come after the things. So the first landscape painting probably wasn't called a landscape painting. You need a number of them before it gets called that. It's just that I have a kind of dual memory of this, because in 1971 I started off on my degree level work as a student, and I was painting something between abstracts and landscapes. Mm-hmm. And I went to an exhibition at the Hayward Gallery called The New Art, which had a huge impact at the time, because it was a kind of introduction to a new generation of what's now become known as conceptual art. So it included Gilbert and George and Michael Craig Martin and all those kinds of people. And, for example, Hamish Fulton and Richard Long, who were both in this Southampton gallery, who in that show essentially showed photographs, although Fulton certainly had texts underneath them, which weren't quite poetic. What was interesting for me is that I found them extraordinarily romantic. And as I remember it, all the photographs by everybody in that exhibition were black and white, which was taken for granted back in 1971. I don't think at that point, and sadly, I used to treasure the catalogue for that show, and sadly I've lost it somewhere, and I realised this some months ago and have not found it since, so I couldn't check. But I don't think at that time people were calling it land art. I just think that Richard Long sat alongside Gilbert and George as, new conceptual artists, and they were young guys at the time. But Long was producing work of the sort where he would walk through a field and leave a trace of a path, or pick daisy heads off in a field and leave a trace, or arrange rocks in a circle on a beach, for example. And at that time, it was mostly photographs. Now, if you go and see the shows of Richard Long in particular, because he's pretty well known, he brings the stuff in and will have assistants to rearrange it. So you go in. They do have a resonance of mystical things. You know, they have a resonance of, you know, the Avebury Stones and of Stonehenge and Glastonbury Tour. There's a certain kind of romantic and spiritual element to quite a lot of this work. And I think Simon's absolutely right to juxtapose it with mid-60s swinging London, Coca-Cola, Beatles, you know, pop music, big cities, fashion, and so on and so on. It was an alternative at the time.
There is one of the things that strikes me about it is there is a real kind of contrast, isn't there, with that sort of modernity, if you like, and that kind of primitive element, and then the kind of idea of arranging and disarranging. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you think about terms that you might describe traditional landscape art with, it might be beautiful, sublime, picturesque, romantic, impressionistic, whereas land art is different. It's more about concepts and processes and situations and information. And it's very much a process-based... It's maybe more an attitude towards your landscape rather than an approach. As Dave mentioned, Richard Long is a very key figure. And the way that the Uncommon Land exhibition at the City Gallery suggests is that this is very much the starting point. And when you first go in, this is the first photograph you're confronted with, which is titled A Line Made by Walking in Grass, 1967.
And the title, very handily for radio, describes exactly what it is.
Yeah. You've got a shot of some grass that looks like it's in a public green area. There's literally like a line in the grass where some of it's somewhat lighter than the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And you wonder at first, how's this been done? Is this bleach? Has he laid something down on here? Is it being denied of the sun for a few days? How has he done it? But it turns out what he's done is he's literally walked up methodically up and down continuously down this patch of grass until it becomes worn, and then taken a simple photograph of it. It's very understated, it's very simple, but this idea of leaving a mark on the landscape the exhibition is suggesting kickstarted a lot.
I think unwillingly I've performed that piece of work on a number of times, cutting across the park where probably I shouldn't have done. There's a real collection, isn't there, in the Southampton show of different land artists.
Yeah,
just tell us about some of the kind of names that they're sort of parading, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much like the beginnings of this genre. So there's artists in here who've gone on to do huge things, some of the biggest artists that we've got. So, for example, Goldsworthy, he goes into nature and he makes sculptures out of natural objects only. So, for example, he won't use any glue or any sticking stuff. It'll only be the water that he finds or the sap from the trees. If he's putting things together, he'll use thorns as pins, or he'll use grass to tie things. And he creates these quite exquisite sculptures. And these have become huge. I mean, his books, there's many of them, have become standard coffee table books, which are available in all good bookstores. And you can probably get his prints in B&Q now. They're that popular. But you've got the early works here. You've got his early stages. Gormley, of course, famous for the Angel of the North and his various figurative sculptures that he puts into the landscape. Mm. You've got his early work here when he was hacking away at trees and making kind of subtle sculptures. So it's very much like some huge names in here, but in their early stages.
There's something I think about kind of water, earth, fire and stone. There's conscious elements in terms of land art. You know, are they reference points that kind of, obviously they go back kind of millions and millions of years probably, but is there a range, is there a toolbox, if you like, that land artists use, or reference points that they use, or is it much more sort of abstract than that?
Well, in a sense, it's limitless. And, I mean, if you get into somebody like Gormley, you begin to talk about people actually taking objects that they've already created into the landscape, which is different from Goldsworthy, who will just get, you know, handfuls of snow and ice and stick them together and is quite content with the idea that eventually they will disappear again. But there's something fundamentally primeval about that, which again I think makes absolute sense against the kind of material, you know, the rushing materialism of the mid-60s. I mean, now we look back on it and find it rather quaint, but at the time it was, you know, and by the late 60s, it's not just the artists that are doing that, because a lot of the kind of swinging 60s people are suddenly, you know, they're turning on, tuning in, dropping out, and going off and living in communes and eating brown rice and growing the hair longer, and, you know, you get all, I mean, that's depicted in films like Easy Rider, and out of it emerges, as well as land art, for people who don't see themselves as artists. The whole ecological green movement comes out of that, the whole Earth Catalogue and so on and so on. So there is a real energy about it at this time. There's a kind of belief that maybe, as Joni Mitchell sang in the Woodstock song, we need to get back to the garden, you know, and the big festivals. You know, we all love the festivals in the mud. I think there is something primeval, fundamental about, you know, playing with mud, playing with sticks, playing with fire, you know, using... And you know, it's what potters do. I mean, potters play with mud, air and fire, essentially, you know, and if you use it in the right way, it's fine. If you get the air in the wrong bits, it blows up. And painters, you know, they dig up the pigment.
Simon, tell me about, I think, possibly one of the best-named land artists in terms of, I think they call it nominative determinism, Tony Cragg. There's some Tony Cragg stuff, I think, in Southampton, which interested me. When I didn't get a chance to go to the gallery, but I looked at some of his work online. Some of it struck me that there was some perhaps deeper resonance to his work.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that first struck me about it was the most colourful piece in there, because you had a lot of black and white photography and a lot of sculptures that were made out of natural forms. But his is actually made out of plastic, colourful objects. What he's done is he's gone along to the River Rhine, which is where he lived at the time, and he's picked up debris off of the bank, as you could do in any river. Yeah. And he's picked up, you know, bits of old plastic containers, toys, you know, just stuff which gets chucked. Tons and tons of the stuff. He's taken it back to the studio and then going via the Newton colour theory of, you know, if you broke up white light, what the spectrum of colour would look like. Mm-hmm. He's arranged these little fragments of objects from red all the way to violet and blue in a kind of rainbow spectrum on the floor, you know, spaced apart in quite a methodical kind of way. And yeah, if you were talking about pop art earlier, it could almost be kind of questioning our consumerism and our, you know, the way that we kind of consume things and then dispose of them. There's something interesting happens when you look at this piece.
You know, we've talked about land art as a contemporary genre starting in the 60s. You know, it does have a long heritage, you know, in terms of white horses on hills, and how many artists, you know, was there one artist and all his workmen around him doing what he told them, you know, and the bloke with his walking stick on another hill, and Stonehenge itself, you know.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about, actually.
Yeah,
you know, it's an Avebury, for example. You know, some of the kind of the work in this exhibition, you can quite. You kind of think, hold on, I've seen that, you know.
Yeah. And we tend to get obsessed by the meaning of it. We, you know, we're always looking for the symbolic. Why Stonehenge there? Why can't it just be there because it actually looks really delightful? You know, in exactly the same way as, you know, when Richard Long walks in a cross over a field and then takes the, you know, why is it there? Because it's delightful. And eventually it will go away again. And that ephemerality of it is also very anti-materialistic, you know, in late 20th century. It is about saying, no, you can't buy this. No, you can't own this. You can't have this. You know, you can have a photograph of it if that's what you want. But actually, you can't own this. And even I, as the artist, can't own it. You know, and go away, think about that a bit. And that's, love it.
One of the stories I particularly liked from the exhibition was that of Andy Goldsworthy, is reading about him. You know, he's huge and he's one of the biggest artists that we have. But he started out very much an artist outside of, you know, the main art world. You know, he went to college, for example, in Bradford and Preston, well away from where land art was taking place at the time. You know, places like St. Martin's in London. He didn't really know about land art, and he was actually, when he started doing it, he would go out independently to, for example, a kind of key, a kind of natural area near him, a bay, Morecambe Bay, and he would work with sand and stones, and he would only photograph the work so he could then go and show it to his tutors when he returned home. And it was only a few years later that he became aware of land art when Richard Long and David Nash came to give a lecture, and, you know, he started to realise there was something else, there's a wider connection here. And you know, I just think it's an interesting thing that these artists, you know, can work in the landscape without really being attached to an art movement. And then later on, the exhibition kind of puts it together.
I want to say a couple of things. One is about that whole process of documentation, which is absolutely crucial because, you know, in the past, and it doesn't matter whether you're looking at Michelangelo or Leonardo or Picasso, we might be captivated by the sketchbooks, and occasionally we get shows of sketchbooks. But by and large, you see the object. you know. And one of the things that happens with this work is that you're much closer to the sense of process, because as soon as you know what Richard Long or Andy Goldsworthy have done, you have a sense of how that's been done and how it's been put together, and the documentation of it, which sometimes is on moving image as well as still image, will document that process. And the other thing it does is to introduce the element of time in a way that a lot of art, it's implicitly taken a long time to make whatever, you know, The Angel of the North. But if you see a film of Goldsworthy working on this ice sculpture, and then you see the ice sculpture melting gradually in the sunlight and disappearing, time becomes another dimension to three-dimensional art. And I think those things are absolutely key, and they're part of the fact that we can do that. You know, they're part of the fact that, that once upon a time it was much harder to do that documentation, and now with you know, mobile phones that make things better than Cecil B. DeMille made with movie cameras, it's a piece of cake.
It's interesting you say that, and just to pick up on a couple of those points, there's some work I think by Anthony McCall in the exhibition which is kind of light focused. So he's using light to kind of display landscape or land, and there is that relationship between light and time, and also, you know, a snapshot as you see it, you know, and it's kind of, you look at his work and you think, you wouldn't say, oh yeah, that's, you know, part of the land art movement, you know, kind of, but you would look at it and think, oh, you know, that's some kind of, you know, pyrotechnic lighting effect or something, you know, from a pop video or a film or whatever. But actually, it's, you know, what he's trying to do, I think he's trying to explore that relationship between instantaneous kind of, you know, visual and time and history, which is, you know, people might say that's, you know, reading into it a little bit more, but, you know, I think he takes it down a quite an interesting different avenue, really.
The Anthony McCall piece was really interesting. Landscape for Fire is a 7-minute video which was choreographed, and it was him filling, or him and some assistants filling and lighting pans of gasoline that were arranged in a grid on a field. It was shot, I believe, at dawn, and there's this very kind of cool blue light. And then it's very ceremonious, you know, they don't say anything, they're all dressed in white, and they walk around one, you know, lighting these pans one by one, and you just hear the pad of the foots walking along the grass, dun 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 dun, then woof, as another pan goes up, orange red kind of light coming from it, and it pans back every now and then, and you've got these kind of guys fully dressed in white wandering around creating this grid of fire. There's something quite ritualistic about it.
There's lots to discuss in terms of land art, and we're going to move on to the other two local exhibitions that we've scouted out. Simon, just for people who want to go across to Southampton and have a look at Uncommon Ground, land art in Britain 66 to 79, just tell us a bit more detail about that in terms of how long it's on for.
Okay, so that's at the Southampton City Gallery, and that's from that's on until the 3rd of August. It's also going to be touring. It's actually being organised by the Arts Council, and it will be going to other places, but this is the most local one to us. So that's on until the 3rd of August.
It is. It's going to the National Museum of Wales in September, I think. It's also going to the Mead Gallery at the University of Warwick and the Longside Gallery at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. So if you find yourself anywhere at those points of the map, I think it's probably worth having a look at.
I'd say so.
And now a brief musical interlude in the way of an assessment, I suppose, of a new anthology, Long Pigs, On and On. Now, anyone who's my age will remember the Long Pigs. They were a big, they weren't a big indie band. I think that's very much where the story starts, really. They were tipped to be a huge indie band, early 90s, and they had only two albums that came out, and they really kind of faded into history, really, and sort of it's mysterious, I think, what happened to them and where they went. But this anthology seeks to right a wrong, as it puts it. I'm not really sure it does that. It kind of does collect a number of their greatest hits, and the irony of that is they didn't really have any hits. On and On is probably the most recognised song of Long Pigs. They had two albums out, one in 1996, The Sun Is Off and Out, and one in 1999, Mobile Home. They had a series of disasters that occurred to them very early on in their career. One was that they signed to Elektra Records in 1993, a huge American label, which then folded its UK arm, and to unravel them from their recording deal, Elektra demanded £500,000 to get out of the deal, which wasn't the best of things to happen to an up-and-coming band. But then at the same time that was happening, their lead singer, Crispin Hunt, was involved in a car accident that put him in a coma for 3 days. So they had a bit of a checkered history. They toured mainly and supported a number of big acts, including Echo Belly, Radiohead, Supergrass, those kind of people. They very nearly made it. I think they're one of those bands that will be remembered for very nearly making it. But for me, I've got a very sort of personal association with some of their music. It's a very kind of nostalgic look back for me. It was a very good time in my life, kind of the mid-90s. I was kind of at university, you know, kind of young undergraduate, kind of out and about, sort of drinking fizzy pop and all those kind of things in the swing of youthful exuberance. But their sound, I just wanted to say something about their sound, a real high-energy sound. The guitar work on the record is, or the two records, is absolutely immense. And anyone that knows anything about Long Pigs will know that Richard Hawley was the lead guitarist, and he has obviously gone on to huge things as a solo artist. And a couple of the other members, Simon Stafford plays bass for Jarvis Cocker now, and I think also went off to play for Joe Strummer and the Musketeeros and some of the albums that he did. This is a very urban sound. This is a very heavy sound. This is kind of Steel City. This is Sheffield kind of at its best. It's kind of a somber mix of pop. There's a lot of angst in there. It pulls on the heartstrings. You know, that's kind of where it's coming from. The voice, the vocal, I think is worth mentioning. Crispin Hunt's vocal is, I think, quite genuine. It's a very genuine voice. It's quite beautiful in some ways, but he does sing with a kind of cracked, kind of shrill, if you like. And it's a kind of, it's another love it or loathe it voice, I think. So, Simon, I threw this disc at you. And you said, "Oh, I vaguely remember Long Pigs." What did you make of it as an anthology? Did it kind of take you back somewhere, or did it make you wonder where you'd heard it?
Yeah, the first half did. There's a succession of four or five tracks which I didn't realise were all by the Long Pigs, and took me back to that era. And you were mentioning things like TFI Friday. It made me think. Do you remember the Shine compilations you used to get?
I do. Yes.
Steve Lamacq and Joe Wiley on the Evening Session. It reminded me of all these things. And so they've got some great songs, and it's got that. I guess they're influenced by quite a lot of American acts as well as UK acts. It's got that Pixies, loud, quiet kind of thing. And they're very melodic, but also very Wall of Noise at parts as well. And they get that nice balance, I think, for indie guitar pop. And yeah, it was great. It really started off well. But the second half, it really sort of fizzled out a bit, I felt. I think you mentioned about the way that it had been compiled. They had their hits, first of all, on the compilation. And then they had a lot of their B-sides and things like that. And it just felt like it stayed for too long. I think if it had been like 10 or 12 tracks at the most, then it would have probably been quite a nice, concise compilation. But it's always a bit depressing to hear a best of when things kind of trail off at the end, and then there's maybe some remix to finish it off because they couldn't find a better track. I kind of felt a bit disheartened towards the end.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, actually, when a band's only had two albums, and quite different albums, to kind of put together a credible anthology. And I was really excited about this coming out because, you know, I was a huge Long Pigs fan. I saw them once in the Sugar House at Lancaster, not the greatest of venues, but they were phenomenal. And they had a number of other bands support them who have gone on to kind of, you know, bigger and better things. I think Embrace were one of their support acts who kind of are still kicking around somewhere, probably on the South Coast, I imagine. But to me, it's not. I thought it was a bit cold, the anthology. It was a bit flabby, and it left out, you know, some real opportunity to put some demos of earlier stuff on there. Some more live stuff would have been nice. Some of the great tracks that I picked up on the B-sides of some of the singles weren't on the anthology.
I guess, is there a difference between, should an anthology kind of draw in a new generation, draw in people that maybe didn't invest in the albums at the time, and then maybe like a kind of B-sides or a kind of outtakes and demos thing, but do something slightly different, you know, for the existing fans? Because if this is aimed at people like myself who haven't bought their stuff, and it's maybe trying to kind of, or maybe a new generation, I think it like you said, it maybe goes on a little bit too long and it doesn't quite do it. I think a more concise, smaller compilation, because I think, to be fair, they're probably a B-grade indie band, aren't they? They're not Radiohead, they're not Suede, they're not all these kind of, but they're somewhere a notch down from there. They'd probably be supporting them at the festival.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to make the point again, they're one of the kind of great lost indie bands, aren't they? The band that never was.
I mean, She Says is a great song. I mean, that first kicked on when I heard that, I was like, yeah, this is great. And the content of it as well, the lyrical content was really well considered. I liked it.
I think one of the rules that they broke in putting this anthology together was I'm not convinced how involved the band members were in actually compiling or pulling together some of the material, which, you know, kind of...
Are they retouring? Are they kind of...
No, they're very much split. They've all gone their very separate ways. Richard Hawley, obviously, is still, you know, having mass success as a solo artist. Crispin Hunt at the moment really focuses most of his time on producing and songwriting. He's written things for Florence and the Machine, for CeeLo Green, for Newton Faulkner, and for Jake Bugg. So a real mixture of different people. Simon Stafford, as I mentioned, still plays with Richard Hawley, and also does some work for Jarvis Cocker. So they've all kind of gone their separate ways. And it's kind of, I suppose there is something about this anthology that sort of says, well, you know, this was a great band that never really kind of, you know, took off, that really never got off the runway, as it were. And they're kind of set, sadly set in Aspic, really. And it kind of, I felt a little bit disappointed, actually, when I listened to this. And I thought, oh, I thought it was going to kind of, you know, really sort of fire this kind of, you know, into the ether. But it didn't. But we're going to try and rectify some of that history now. And we're going to play a track, which isn't perhaps an obvious track of theirs, but a track I really like. It's off their second album called Mobile Home. And this is a track called Blue Skies. We continue now with Land Art, a bit of a theme to ground us from a previous excursion at sea. And I went along to the John Hanser Gallery at the University of Southampton and had a look at an exhibition which is of Nancy Holt and Robert Smithson's work. Bit of a strange one. It focuses on a trip to the UK in August and September of 1969, a month-long trip that the two artists undertook. And it's really a collection of photo, a couple of video installations, and a recreation of some of Robert Smithson's work. It's a strange bundle of things, and I have to... I was saying to Dave and Simon just before we put the mics up that I didn't really know what to make of it when I went in there. The first thing that greeted me was a pile of gravel with some mirrors all around of it, and I thought, I'm not quite sure about this, whether this is the art exhibition or the installation or whether part of the ceiling has come down and I shouldn't actually be in here. But the gallery itself is just white space, so I kind of thought, I'm probably safe here. There's no men at work signs or anything like that. And I stood there looking at it for a good 5 or 10 minutes thinking, I'm not sure I get that. But it's really, I suppose, what it's trying to do is look at... Well, it was a key word that struck me in some of the things I read at the exhibition. There's a word called entropy, which I hadn't really come across before. Scientists will have picked that word up, probably because I think it relates to thermodynamics in some way. But it's about order and disorder. And I thought, well, that's a key to help me try and work out some of this. It's kind of something about arrangement and the purpose of the object that's the focus for the art being arranged separately or in a different way from the original intent. There are a number of pictures of quarries with mirrors in them and bushes with mirrors in them. And I think what Robert Smithson was trying to get to was to try and demonstrate the natural occurrence of things, but also to show there was an intervention by man that was reflecting that, which I probably haven't explained very well. But there was a real, you know, he was trying to sort of say, well, you know, this is a beautiful thing. I've interacted with it to amplify that beautiful thing rather than, you know, distract you from it being a beautiful thing. It was a confusing set of art. There are a number of instamatic images. Now, instamatic, I think, to me means Polaroid, but I don't, you know, you can explain the process for that to me. But there are a number of prints around the room of Dartmoor, and specifically walking points on Dartmoor. So, you know, just bits of the moor where you had lumps of granite and a little orange dot on the stone or the gate or, you know, that bit of the landscape. And I thought, well, you know, I grew up in Devon, I know Dartmoor fairly well, and I thought, what point is this trying to make? How is this different from a postcard I could buy in Widdicombe, for example? And I reflected on it a little bit and thought about it a little more. I thought, well, the dots are about mapping the land and about guiding people, or in some ways distracting them from what the wider picture is in the moor, if you see what I mean. You're trying to engineer a process or an experience for someone. Okay, it's trying to guide somebody through a landscape in a particular way. And I thought, well, that is the kind of idea of order and disorder, I think, that they're trying to potentially get to.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I think there's a sense in which all land and landscape art does that. So the work we've just, even, you know, when Richard Long takes a walk across a field, he takes a walk across a particular bit of field and then takes a photograph of it with the line that he's just walked in the middle of it. So he's framing it. I mean, we're sitting in a studio at the minute, and the three of us, if we choose to, can, Simon's got his back to it, but he could choose to turn around and look out the window, in which case there are bits of buildings down Arundel Street and bits of trees poking up, and we're on about the third floor, so you can see the top of the trees. I mean, that's in a sense the order that an artist brings. The framing gives it an order. What the framing also does, by choice, is exclude a whole bunch of other stuff. You know, that if we could sit on the windowsill, and I'm too scared of heights to do it, but if we could sit on the windowsill, we could choose much more which bits of Arundel Street or down towards the railway and Guildhall and so on we looked at. And that's what artists do. They kind of do some ordering for us. And I think they imply that there's less order in nature. Now, of course, in one sense, you know, the laws of nature are such that there isn't less order at all. You know, nature is a very ordered thing, but it's also visually often a very messy thing. So I think that very often, you know, just that act of putting the orange dot on it and then taking that photograph rather than a different one begins to create a kind of order of some sort, a narrative order, a generic order, whatever.
The other thing that struck me was there was something about the mirrors that Smithson was using. Was what he was trying to do was show that there is a natural process of displacement, if you like, and the mirror is reflecting that. Yeah. But also, the mirror being there and placed in a kind of, I suppose, in a sort of circular, almost like a flower arrangement, if you like, it being there has an effect in itself, which... You know,
well, the mirror, for example, is a very big device in things like film noir. You know, if you think of that Orson Welles film at the end where he's in the crazy mirrors in the fairground and there's a shootout and you can't see whether you're seeing, and the guy keeps shooting the mirror and the mirror fractures and then you see more fragmented things. But if you know, you don't have to start shooting in the Smithson thing, but you can walk into a show like that and if you stand in front of the mirror in a certain way, you place yourself in the you see yourself in the landscape, don't you? Because it reflects back. The landscape reflects back behind you, and once you see yourself in it, place yourself in a work of art, it becomes a different work of art, you know, because you can't do that in an oil painting. You know, you can sometimes do it in a watercolour painting if it's got glass front and the lighting isn't quite right. You see yourself reflected in it, but one of the things you can do there is, you know, is frame yourself and be in that work of art.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I suppose we've touched on this already, I think, in terms of land art. You know, I wonder if there's a theme in land art about contrasting random order with natural order.
Yeah.
I mean, random order sounds nonsensical, but you know, it is about contrast, isn't it?
Yes.
And about, I suppose it is about quite primal relationships. You know, we were saying, you know, you were saying that society is quite urban these days, you know, and there's a kind of, you know, there's an urban sprawl, if you like, but you know, we are dominated by cities and towns, aren't we? You know,
and they are essentially right-angled things. You know, and nature is essentially not right-angled.
Certainly out of that window you just described. There's certainly many a right angle out of there. For me, it was an exhibition that made me think. And as I said to you earlier, well, you know, it's kind of done its job. Yeah. If you're keen to check that out, the Holt and Smithson exhibition is on at the John Hansard Gallery up until the 17th of August. And it's brought to us by the Henry Moore Foundation and SGL Group. I believe that they gather gravel. Now, as we continue the theme of land art, now let's move to Paul Nash. And Dave, this is one particularly that you wanted us to explore. You mentioned it in the last show.
Yeah.
And this kind of, I suppose, brought us to exploring this genre of art.
Well, I have a real fondness for Paul Nash, which is a personal thing, because actually, if we go back to the Southampton City Gallery, when I was a student, it was about 1973, I think, I spent a week in a workshop with about eight other students in the basement, and we were allowed to choose one piece of work and do all kinds of research and work around it and actually make a version of it. And I made a version of a Paul Nash painting at the time called Landscape Over the Malvern Distance. The exhibition at Chichester is a very small, modest, very darkly lit show, because it's a lot of it is ink on paper, which might be words and might be drawings. He made a lot of black and white drawings. Some of it is designs for book covers, which reveal a real interest in the modernism that was beginning to be acknowledged in Britain in the interwar period. And we were much slower to pick up on abstraction than the Europeans, you know. So Mondrian had been making his coloured squares for years before most British artists did. And when British artists came to it, by and large, they did come to it through landscape, which I think is a significant thing again. So Ben Nicholson would be a classic example of that. But Paul Nash, to some degree, and certainly in these book designs. But I ought to just tell a bit about... There is a specific room devoted to this exhibition. It's an exhibition collected together by a woman who was a great friend of Nash for a long, long time. And so it consists of, you know, drawings and sketches and letters and, you know, bits of work that he made that might be used or might not be used, and prints, because he made quite a lot of prints, etchings and lithographs and all sorts of things. It is, again, in an English sense, modest in scale. You know, it is work that you have to get quite close to, and most of it is exercise book size. It's not big paintings on the wall, although the Pallant Gallery in Chichester, where it's being held, does have paintings of that period by many British artists, and a lot of them landscape artists. So you can come out of that and wander around and see, you know, if you like, more conventional landscape paintings. I just think there are one or two crucial things to say about Paul Nash. The first is that he had traumatic experiences in the First World War, and I suspect that a lot of those will be revisited, those experiences will be revisited in a year's time, you know, when it seems clear to me that there's going to be a big focus on 1914 to 1918. Mm. And he was a war artist, and he made some works which he was always in touch with surrealism, and he made some works which have a kind of surreal element to them, but a kind of bleakly surreal element. And had a nervous breakdown after he came back from the First World War and was clearly traumatised, and spent time down in Kent and various places and rehabilitated himself and became a different kind of artist. But an artist who quite often explored what I guess you would call the mystical elements of landscape, but from a very strong technical background. So there was nothing sloppy or wishy-washy about this. But again, it's a kind of work which I think, along with a lot of the stuff that you see at the Southampton Gallery at the moment, the Land Art, a lot of it does appeal to the romantic, which is a pretty strong characteristic in the British psyche, I think. I don't mean that everybody's a romantic, but I mean that there is a really quite strong romantic spirit within us and within the culture that we've inherited. And it's one that I rather like, actually, although sometimes, you know, you do need to come back to earth and go do the shopping. But but in the end, I think it's a really modest but a really fascinating show, because it reveals so much about processes and thinking and ideas, and the letters themselves just tell all kinds of stories about his mood and what's in his mind and what he's thinking about. Really quite intimate letters to another human being who's made them available, and it's quite lovely.
There was something I read, I think it was a quote from Nash himself. He said that places were like people and objects, that they create mystery and enchantment. And I really like that kind of the idea, and it links to what you just said about the kind of romantic ethos. And I wondered, in terms of him, you know, being a war artist and being sort of traumatised by the war, I wondered how that, inevitably, that's going to sort of tinge his view of the land. But it struck me, a number of the pieces at the Pallant Gallery, the Pallant House Gallery, you know, it was very much about kind of lines and barriers and territory, you know, very much exploring the kind of geometry of the landscape, really.
That's very perceptive. I mean, I think that's partly to do with the artwork that was emerging around abstraction at the time. And Mondrian is the kind of, you know, is the leader of all of that across Europe, that very geometric thing. You know, where, you know, the story told of Mondrian is that he started off painting lots of trees in a kind of post-impressionist style. And these trees became more and more grid-like. And eventually the grids became simply horizontal and vertical lines and rectangles. And then one day he hit on the idea of getting nature completely out of his painting. So he only paints in red, yellow, blue, black and white, because he's, you know, he says, you know, nature is full of green and brown, so I will have no green and brown. And then he says nature is full of flowing lines and round lines and wavy lines, so I will have only rectangles and squares and verticals and horizontals, you know. And yet there is a deeply spiritual underpinning to his work, you know. It's not just tablecloth design, for example. Yeah. Well, the British never quite got there, really. I mean, Ben Nicholson a little bit, but Nash... Nash is kind of 75% there, but always in the middle of it there's some kind of mysticism, or there's a bit of dynamic through a diagonal line or something. Mm. But it's a perceptive comment. I think you're absolutely right about it in broad terms. Yeah.
A lot of the work as well in the is copper and wood engraving, isn't it? Yeah. Mainly those are mainly the kind of materials that he would have used. Yeah. And I thought, well, you know, that's quite, I'm no artist, but that's quite blocky, you know, that's quite heavy in terms of dark blocks and dark spaces. And then it occurred to me, well, actually he's not trying to get that across. What he's trying to get across is the light between those things, you know, between those kind of menacing and dark shapes and, you know, dark abstractions. He's actually trying to focus on the kind of the bits of the page that he hasn't touched, if you like.
But then he does print a lot in black and white. I mean, or at least he lets the white paper stay, and he just prints in black. I mean, he could choose to paint, to print, you know, using more natural colours, but he doesn't. It is very stark. And
so he's kind of limited himself to those things, because in terms of what they can express.
Yeah. And, of course, the other thing about those materials, you know, wood blocks and copper and so on, is that they are inherently natural materials. You know, there's something, you know, screen printing and its modern versions, you know, and certainly printing off a computer screen, you do all sorts of clever things, but at no point are you touching messy, dirty, real stuff that's been hewn out of the earth. And, you know, I think there is a very interesting relationship there between the materials you use to make the work and the thing you are depicting in it, you know. And I mean, I've done work with video camera and computer screen stuff, which is landscapey and distorted images and so on, but there's always a bit of me that thinks, I'm not sure this is quite right.
I think you're cutting some corners.
Well, I'm a romantic old fogey, probably, you know, and it's probably perfectly fine to do it, but it seems funny to plug things in and then make pictures of landscapes, you know.
It's a bit removed, but it reminds me of a thing I read by Roland Barthes, which is about the critic Roland Barthes. He was encouraging children to play with wooden toys because there's more of a resonance there, because they're the natural world, and not to play with plastic toys. Yeah. Can the same be said when you're making art? Is there more resonance if you're using natural materials? I guess some people would argue so, definitely. Yeah.
And there's something rather lovely, isn't there, about going into shops, antique shops, and finding old wooden toys where you have some real sense of fingerprints having been on them and them having been handled and caressed, because they're wearing... Actually, even old tools are like it. Mm. You know, you buy an old hammer and you have this sense of somebody holding the hammer. But if you go buy a rubber and steel hammer, you don't... You know, it's just an old rubber and steel hammer somehow. You know, it's... I think that's absolutely true.
Well, it's interesting, because a couple of things I really liked in the exhibition, I couldn't take out the glass and handle. You know, so for example, the kind of full orange leather songbook, I think it is.
Yeah.
You know, an amazing looking thing, which is, you know, really sort of precisely kind of designed and really intricately kind of designed. You know, you'd think, oh yeah, that's really tactile. I want to get out and have a look at it. But you can't, you know, it's stuck there kind of behind the glass in the kind of dim light to preserve it. I also really liked, I don't know if you picked up on this, Dave, but I also liked the Shell Guide to Dorset.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which I think he was involved in, which was commissioned, I think, by John Betjeman.
They were famous, those guides. I have one for Hampshire. Yeah, which sadly Nash didn't do, but Nash did quite a lot of them, and his brother John as well. And Betjeman quite often wrote in them. A bit like the documentary movement of the 30s, where they used to get hold of really quite major poets and composers of the time and get them to, you know, collaborate. And, I mean, for Shell, it was an advertising campaign, but they did them for almost every county, as far as I'm aware. I have the Hampshire one, and it's just absolutely delightful because it's beautifully written, you know, by poets, and beautifully illustrated, and there's nice photographs in it, and so on and so on. So it sounds like a funny thing. And I remember as a kid in primary schools, and well, what are we talking about, 1955, 6, 7, something like that. I remember Shell. I didn't have any idea about what Shell was at the time, but I remember them producing big images of the British seashore or something, and they were kind of numbered things, so it told you that this was a seagull and that was a crab, and, you know, that was like on the primary school wall, you know. So Shell, in those days, it seems ironical somehow, you know. Shell that's, you know, encouraging us all to pave everything over and get rid of the landscape and have more motorways and more cars. And
now, there's also a monster, isn't there, in this exhibition? Yeah. Now, the monster is a strange thing, but it's essentially a kind of a tree that's fallen over in a field and a kind of photographic sort of document of that.
Yeah. It's exactly what it is, and he just... it's about his imagination. And I think what we, I mean, it looks rather quaint now if you look at it these days and think, well, what, you know, it is just a huge tree trunk with its roots sticking out and its branches sticking out. And, it, you know, you can imagine persuading kids that it's a monster and getting them to play on it and so on. But for the rest of us, are we sure about that? And then you have to say to yourself, well, this was done in the 1930s when, you know, OK, maybe somebody had made the first version of King Kong. But by and large, you know, we weren't bombarded endlessly with moving images and photographs of, you know, horror movies and all and fantasy and so on and so on. You had to engage your imagination more in the everyday world and see possibilities and things. And I think, you know, rather than see it as this oddly quaint thing as it might be seen nowadays, you know, you might, you know, if you've got 5-year-old kids, you might pretend that, but otherwise you wouldn't. I think you have to think 1930s, surrealism, the whole, you know, that whole inhabiting a different space from ordinary life.
There is, for me as well, I mean, I looked at it and thought, well, that's quite funny. It's, you know, a man in a suit running around, after, you know, looking for a monster in a tree. But then I kind of thought, well, actually, there's probably something in that about his kind of demons that he's being chased by from the war. But there's also something about, you know, it probably struck a chord with him in terms of, you know, a very natural destruction, you know, of a huge natural thing just being knocked over in the wind, or, you know.
He painted a war picture called Dead Sea. You know, he had this image in his mind of nature being dead, and he painted many pictures of stark areas around the trenches with you know, bombed trees, you know, that were clearly dead. And I think maybe he was freeing it up by being playful with something that could otherwise have taken, you know. I think that point is important. He comes back from the desolation of landscape and tries to find salvation in the British landscape through a kind of romanticism, rather than rejecting land forever, you know, saying, well, you know, this is, I hate the sea because I nearly drowned once. You know, he's saying, no, I'm going to go back to the land and try and rediscover the magic that I know is there, that it was actually the humans who destroyed it, not the land.
One thing I absolutely loved that I saw, which can't be, I don't think, classed as a piece of his work, but it was a postcard, and it is a very personal sort of exploration, really, isn't it, in terms of their relationship. There's a postcard, and its postmark from 1946 said, "Don't waste bread, others need it." And it just kind of struck me. It was, you know, it was really sort of, you know, it told you a lot about the kind of the British sense of humour at a time of, you know, kind of extreme austerity and kind of chaos. Yeah. But yeah, very, you know, kind of very real, a very real kind of bit of history, really.
It's for me, it's highly recommended because it gives you insights into living the way that an artist lived and the processes he went through, not just the things he finished up sticking on a wall. And I like it for that.
Let's talk a bit about music, because we can't neglect music on this programme, because, why would we? And, Dave, you've been sort of provoking people to make suggestions about land-related music.
I start from popular music, although in this respect I got pushed very quickly towards 20th century British classical music. And I did ask people to think British and to say, did they agree with me that essentially popular music had become a largely urban thing? Well, it explores two sorts of things. It's largely urban, or it's largely emotional in terms of personal relationships. So it's not about the external world at all. It's about the internal world. And maybe, you know, maybe that's a thing, in finally, that actually you can paint pictures of the landscape, and it's much harder to make songs about the landscape. But clearly, all I did was to use a thing called the Pompey Pop blog, which I run, which is by and large people of my generation, 50s, 60s people who've, you know, had a lifetime of music, and say, what do you reckon about, you know, music to do with the land and the earth and mud and stones and all that kind of thing? And sure enough, you know, I mean, I wrote some stuff down. Sure enough, almost immediately they came up with, even though they're all pop rock and roll fans and so on, they came up with Grieg and Delius and Percy Grainger and Ralph Vaughan Williams and Elgar and so on and so on, and eventually began to explore other stuff. But an awful lot of it, in fairness, was music of the late 60s, you know. So there was a very strong element that came out of the swinging 60s that moved into the hippie thing, which became more rural than at any other time in popular music. And people like Donovan, and of course the Fairport Convention and that whole folk rock revival, Steely Span, Vashti Bunyan. She writes songs explicitly about things to do with the land sometimes. That whole tradition of Martin Carthy and so on. Then we began to shift a little bit into more ambient stuff like Brian Eno and Enya. Brian Eno, I think, particularly is kind of interesting because he certainly makes... But also what we're doing then is moving away from song into ambient sound. Mm. And that takes us back to those classical people like Grieg and Delius and so on, which is it easier if you're going to make landscape music to make it instrumental? Is it easier to avoid words, you know? And there are other traditions, of course. There are traditions like Morris dancing, which has very explicit kind of music, which takes place in essentially rural contexts. Mm. But does it in the sense of Richard Long or Paul Nash or anybody else reveal to us anything about the land, or is it just things that go on in the land?
Well, that's it for this show, and in fact, this series. But if you want to find out some of the things that we've been up to and check our archive of programmes, you can go to our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. We'll be back in September, and there'll be a catch-up programme broadcast in August, so we're not going away completely. But we've still got stuff to do now. Let's take a look at some events that are happening locally. You can check out Neil Innes at the Cellars at Eastney on the 16th of August as part of a programme of summer comedy.
At the Guildhall, they're developing a new set of galleries about popular music, and coming pretty soon, I think in July, is an exhibition by a photographer who focused on the Rolling Stones, I think probably in their early period. So lots and lots of pictures of Mick and the Boys about the time they appear at Glastonbury.
Excellent, we'll check that out.
The Artspace Studios are offering an open studios weekend on Saturday the 29th and Sunday the 30th of June. It's an opportunity to meet with professional artists, over 30 I believe, and possibly purchase artwork as well.
Excellent. Now, if you fancy a bit of jazz, you can go along on June 29th to part of the Portsmouth Festivities Contemporary Jazz Workshop with Jojo Williams at the Groundlings Theatre at 1:30 p.m. It's free and there's no need to book. Check the portsmouthfestivities.co.uk website for more information. I think I might be doing a bit of freeform scat or something along those lines to that. Just before we go, I'd like to thank all of those who've contributed across the series and supported the programme. Some of those people will be coming back in the next series, which starts again in September. I'd like to say thank you to Dave Allen, our new boy, who joined us in the second series. He's now very much an old lag.
I was going to say, I'm the oldest new boy in the world.
Arno. And also our very own Art Funnel. That's what I'm going to call him, our Art Funnel, Simon Mobbs. As I said, check out the blog, there's lots on there. And Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.